And welcome to another week of Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. And Avi, I had to start the show by saying congratulations to the Eagles. And I know you're a huge, lifelong Eagles fan. And
I offer condolences to you? Or?
Well, you know, I wanted to tell you, and I have on green. You probably can't tell because it's a darker shade of green. But I came out to my dad this weekend. I'm an Eagles fan now.
Oh, wow. That's heavy.
I'm an Eagles fan now. My dad said he always knew.
How did he take it?
He took it pretty well because, you know, I refuse to speak badly about the Washington football team.
Yes.
Because I grew up around with this football family. But my dad was like, we all know that you're sitting there with Eagles gear on right now and it's okay.
What a touching moment. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah,
Sherry.
But I know you were, when we, Avi and I talked yesterday and he was flapping his arms.
Giving him the wing flap.
Gave him the wing flap.
I'm so happy to have you on the team, fully committed. Thank you so much, Cherry. Can I just also, if you're watching on YouTube, Hello
Hi.
To our studio tubers,
Tater
our spot
tots.
Buds. I just want to apologize, and I know I got a situation going on my face.
What happened?
I got a beard, an attempt at a beard.
Okay.
And it is
That's
because...
That's so Philly, though.
It is because this was by accident, but I happened to shave right before the Eagles playoff run started, and now I'm scared to shave again.
Yeah.
So I think I'm just going to let it go.
Let it go. You only got a couple more weeks.
It could get gnarly. I don't have naturally a great beard.
You're forgiven in advance because you're doing it. You're taking it for the team.
It takes all of us.
Yeah, it takes all of us.
Jerry.
So, you know, last week I watched the inauguration.
Yeah.
I don't know if you did or not. And one thing that stood out to me and was consistently highlighted throughout the ceremonies was who got a front row seat to history that day. On the front row, you had Elon Musk, you had Jeff Bezos, you had Mark Zuckerberg, you had the head of Google, you had the head of, you know, all these companies.
Apple.
Yeah, Apple.
OpenAI
was there. OpenAI, all there. And I thought, wow, wow. Millions of Americans use their products, services, and technology. These individuals could wield such power over us in our everyday lives. And now they are very influential enough to get a front row seat with President Donald Trump. And so you have been saying, we got to talk about oligarchy here.
Yeah.
And we thought, you know what we do here at Studio 2?
Let's go deep.
Let's go deep and do a show about it.
Let's do a whole show about it.
And so we got an expert coming in. We have a reporter that's going to be on the show. And so our question for you today is this. Are you worried about the role of tech billionaires, the role that they're playing in the Trump administration and their influence on policy and politics? Are you worried about the role tech billionaires are playing in the Trump administration and their influence on policy and politics? That is the question for today. We want you to call us 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And for those of you on YouTube, you can leave your comments in the chat.
And it is technically a yes or no question, but don't just say yes or no.
No.
Come on. Give us a why.
Well, these are you know, our tubers. You know what I mean? They know.
That's right.
They know.
That's right. So, before we get to all of that, we always start the show with a trio of local news stories. And we'll start with one that's a local story that has made national headlines. News broke late yesterday. Workers at a Whole Foods location near the Art Museum voted 130 to 100 to form a union. If that holds up, this would be the first Whole Foods store to unionize. Whole Foods, linked to today's show, is owned by Amazon, which has fought very hard against unionization efforts at its warehouses and among its drivers. For instance, Amazon has refused to bargain with a union formed in Staten Island in 2022.
Yeah.
So that's the background here. That's why people are paying such close attention to this one unionization effort at this one Whole Foods in Philadelphia. And we'll see where it goes, and we'll see exactly how Amazon responds. But it is a very notable first volley that I think people have been waiting on.
Yeah, and good reporting by WHYY business reporter Kristen Musburger-Garza, who wrote about this. And two things stood out to me in this story. Number one, that the people at Whole Foods had a whole different experience before Amazon bought it. You know, they had these benefits, they had stock options, holiday bonus pay. And they said everything sort of changed once Amazon took over in 2017 and sort of corporatized, you know, things happening there. And the second thing that stood out to me, kind of connects with today's show, is the politics. People are really afraid that the Trump administration will be anti-union and will sort of make it really hard for them to unionize.
Yeah. And of course, this all comes at an interesting time for the union movement in America. If you look at opinion polls, for instance, Gallup, more Americans approve of labor unions now than at any point since the 60s. Mm-hmm. That's the good news for union organizers. However, if you look at actual unionization rates among workers in the public and private sector, they're low, historically low. And so will the favorable view of unions among now a solid majority of Americans, will that translate to actual unionization, especially when you're facing up against a behemoth like an Amazon, or we could talk, we can bring in Elon Musk. He always comes into the Tesla or SpaceX or whatever. Right. And so this is one of the big battles for the future of the American workforce. And a little part of it is taking place here in Philadelphia. Of course, we'll keep our eye on it. Let's move to story number two now, Cherry.
Let's move on. Philadelphia fans went wild this weekend. You all remember people were filing into the streets. They celebrated the Eagles NFC Championship win. Go Birds there. But the celebrations had some dark moments, Avi. An 18-year-old fan, by the way, is in critical condition after falling from a light pole during those celebrations over the weekend. This man apparently climbed that light pole near 15th and Market Streets, and at some point he fell, he hit his head, and it caused a brain injury. All of this, according to our news partner, 6ABC. And if you recall, before the game, Mayor Sherrell Parker warned people. They said, she said, do not climb the poles. You don't want to be in a celebratory moment and have a tragedy occur. And of course, now this young man is on life support. But this was only one of a number of injuries that happened during the festivities. There were a couple people were shot. They're going to be okay, though. We had eight people were hit by a car that drove through a crowd in the Spring Garden neighborhood. There was a stabbing and one police officer was assaulted. All of this reported by our news partner. But it just goes to show, I mean, there's a lot that can happen. And while most people were safe and while it was a lot of fun, it can get dangerous. And this, Avi, wasn't even the celebration post Super Bowl win. Yeah. This is NFC Championship win celebrations.
Yeah. And it's so hard for me to process this because on some level, this is really a beautiful thing. Like we can just see in our YouTube chat, people talking about their love for the Eagles and their excitement. Yeah. And one person saying like, I don't even follow football, but living in the Philly area has made me a Birds fan. And we talked about this before the show, like football is like the last remnant of the monoculture. It's something that sort of everyone buys into and rallies around, especially the local team. And so you have these beautiful street celebrations where strangers are embracing. And I've been part of those. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, it can get a little wild in a fun way. But then inherently there's risk baked into all of that. This is, I mean, it's just hard for me to accept that a young fan goes out to celebrate this.
Just having fun.
And the whole poll thing, too, has become like a national storyline. Like the Tonight Show, they're talking about the polls and the greasing the polls. And it was this joke. It is this joke in a sense. But then you have to appraise what's actually happening from a crowd control, from a safety perspective. Yeah. I don't know enough about this to understand what authorities should or should not be doing in these cases. You know,
because you don't want it to get combative or anything. And people are just having fun. Yeah. But at the same time, you don't want this to happen. By the way, healing mercies to that young person on life support. And I hope they end up being OK.
We'll move to our third story now. This comes via Philly Mag, a really interesting story about the possibility of there being a pop-up metro line in Philadelphia.
A pop-up metro. Explain this, please.
I'm glad you asked. If you're along the Delaware River waterfront, Columbus Boulevard specifically, there are existing railroad tracks there from long ago. And there is this company called Pop-Up Metro that says that they could install for super cheap, just like a little light rail that just goes up and down the boulevard from about the, you can see the map there if you're on YouTube, from about the Race Street Pier, which is near the Ben Franklin Bridge, all the way down to like Reed Street in South Philly. It's just that stretch. But they have like, they have this system. It's almost like a, I mean, pop-up is the word that they use, right? Where they give you like the cars and the employees and like the logistics.
So
and
all the tools.
All the tools.
Yeah.
To run sort of, it's like a, almost like a test line to see if it would work. Mm-hmm. And the Delaware River Waterfront Corporation, which runs, controls all that area down there around the waterfront, is like interested in this. And they've put a survey out asking people whether they would ride this service. It could be like a semi-permanent thing, or it could be proof of concept for some larger transit project in the future. I had never heard of this idea before.
Yeah.
I can't tell if it's like just a novelty or like something that could really work.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me because we've been semi obsessed with all the happenings
just
along the waterfront. I mean,
just a little.
There's all this new housing. There's a casino.
Yeah.
There's a cruise lines are going to have, you know, a new port there coming up. And so
it always comes back to the cruises.
I know. I like that. But I mean, and it sounds like, and one of the things I noticed is that it doesn't cost a lot to because the infrastructure
right.
is kind of built there comparative. If you compare it to actually having build tracks and all of that.
Exactly.
This is a few hundred thousand dollars compared to millions and millions,
millions
and millions.
Exactly.
And so it's
I don't exactly know who needs to get from the Ray Street Pier to South Philly and back, but I
somebody.
Guess you could conceivably like connect to other transit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a totally interesting idea. And by the way, officials in Westchester are interested in this same concept for that city to reconnect them to the SEPTA line. So maybe it could work. Philly has a lot of legacy rail tracks.
Yeah,
you could
we
just,
do.
You go around the city and you'd be like, why are there tracks in the street here? There were trolley tracks. There was.
It makes me nervous, though. I'm like, is a train going to come? I don't know. But
it's not, I can assure you. But this could be a way to get to reuse some old infrastructure.
Love it.
Anyways.
Our question for you today is, are you worried about the role tech billionaires are playing in the Trump administration and their influence on policy and politics? Email studio2@whyy.org.
People got thoughts already.
Yeah, looking forward to having this conversation on the other side of this break. We'll be right back.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. In his farewell address, former President Biden had a warning for America.
An oligarchy is taking shape in America of extreme wealth, power, and influence that literally threatens our entire democracy, our basic rights and freedoms, and a fair shot for everyone to get ahead. We see the consequences all across America, and we've seen it before. More than a century ago, but the American people stood up to the robber barons back then and busted the trusts. They didn't punish the wealthy. This made the wealthy play by the rules everybody else had to.
And then days later, President Trump's inauguration seemed to make Biden's case. There flanking the new president were some of the richest men in the world. Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, along with the CEOs from Apple, Google, and OpenAI. They even stood in front of Trump's cabinet nominees.
So is Biden right to be worried about this cozy relationship between the tech billionaires and the Trump administration? Haven't rich people always had more influence on presidents and in politics than the rest of us, using their wealth to buy access and favors? Or are these billionaires from Silicon Valley something new and more concerning?
What do you think? Are you worried about the role tech billionaires are playing in the Trump administration and their influence on policy and politics? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on our YouTube channel, non-ironically, I'll tell you to drop your comments in the live chat.
And to give us some background on these billionaires, we've asked NPR technology correspondent Bobby Allen to join us. Bobby, welcome to Studio 2.
Hey, guys. Good to be here.
Nice to see you. And with us in studio is Swarthmore College visiting assistant professor Gordon Arlen, who is working on a book about oligarchy.
Great
Welcome.
To be here. Thank you.
So, Bobby, we want to start with you. You know, this is like such a broad question. I'm hoping you can help us break it down. But the question I always ask myself is, what do these tech titans from Silicon Valley want? Do they just want some regulations that are helpful to their businesses, or are their ambitions truly broader than that?
Well, of course, if you ask them, they're not going to admit to any of this, but it doesn't take much thinking to come up with the ways in which they can be benefited from having a direct line into the White House, right? But Ezra Klein did a piece about this recently, and I think he kind of hit the nail on the head that it's not just about contracts and favors, but it's about centrality and attention, right? That not only do these tech billionaires get to influence the congressional agenda, foreign policy, federal programs, but in Elon Musk, Trump gets yet another way to stay in the headlines, a very powerful and far-reaching social media platform in X, formerly Twitter, and just, you know, this almost catnip sort of thing that the media just can't stop writing about. I mean, when you have, you know, more than a dozen billionaires in Trump's cabinet, it's just, it's hard not to want to apply scrutiny and to write about this, because you have Trump coming in and partnering with these sort of unelected tech industrialists. And if you're into sort of portraying that side as sort of evil and cynical, it doesn't take much to do that, right? So I think two things, that, you know, contracts, things that policies that sort of benefit their bottom line, and just staying in the headlines.
Hmm. I also am curious if there is a prevailing feeling in tech circles that these folks know better than us, and we would be better served if they were sort of more in charge. Because I think a lot hinges on just how prevalent that feeling is. And of course, it's going to differ from person to person. But how do you sort of begin to try to approach that question, Bobby?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a long time, there's been sort of an antagonistic relationship that really reached its peak in the Biden administration. You had a Department of Justice and a Federal Trade Commission that went to war with big tech, because this so-called tech lash movement, you know, as society has increasingly been grappling with the ways in which these companies are throwing their power around and suppressing rivals and dominating markets, there's been this growing movement that Biden really took the reins of to try to, you know, crack down on Silicon Valley. And what has that meant for these executives who historically have been either centrists or Democrats? For them, it's meant being dragged in front of Congress. It's meant investigations. It's meant prosecutions. It's meant a lot of money that they're paying their legal departments to comply with all of these government probes. And yeah, I think to answer your question, during the antagonistic moment, they were just at war with the administration. And they've always, of course, thought that they are sort of have more brilliant insights than our elected leaders do when it comes to national policy. But in Trump, they see both a way to avoid the regulations and the investigations, and also a way to directly influence policy. And they obviously have anointed themselves the rich, not anointed themselves the richest, but they are the richest and most influential people in the world, and they have anointed themselves the most innovative. So yes, they would love to control and call the shots on policy, and some of them do think that they're more, you know, well suited to do that than our elected leaders.
So just following that logic then, And I feel like I've heard it defined in so many different ways. They're libertarian, they're centrists, they're Democrats that are, fed up with the woke left, whatever. Like, what are the sort of political theories that have a lot of currency in these circles that might not be like the prevailing political theories in Washington? Are there fringe theories that are popular in Silicon Valley that, would maybe shock people in the establishment? Like, if they're coming with a worldview, what, broadly speaking, is that worldview?
It's hard to talk about this because obviously it's not exactly a monolith when it comes to the rank and file, but sort of generally speaking, many of the people who work at Google and Meta and Amazon and Microsoft and OpenAI tend to be sort of libertarian leaning, but when it comes to social issues, they tend to be more liberal. Many are just not that political. I mean, if you look at a movement not too long ago to unionize some of the big tech companies, if you look at the numbers of people who actually participated in those unions, it's a couple hundred, a couple thousand in companies that sometimes exceed 100,000
Wow.
employees. So, I mean, a lot of these people are just kind of nerds who are just, rise and grind, wake up every day and are just like ones and zeros coding into the late hours and maybe have a political opinion that has something to do with like keep your hands off of crypto and, let me code until the end of time. But it's not, I mean, I'm now in Los Angeles where, there's a big tech scene with TikTok and Snapchat and others. But when I was in Silicon Valley and I would talk to these software engineers, many of them are just not political animals in the same way you'll see people in DC having like really, really strong political opinions. But among the executives, I mean, they just are self-preservationists. They want to retain the power they have. They obviously want to make sure that shareholders are happy and they're transactional. They see in Trump a way to seek favors, right? And this is not, we shouldn't talk about these tech executives as if they're doing something new. This has been happening for generations. I mean, industry loves influencing politicians to get their way, but the number of executives who are sort of banding together and doing it, and just the public displays of it are just really head spinning and egregious.
And I want to bring Gordon Arlen into this conversation. And Gordon, I want to just can you give us some basics, and then I want you to react to what Bobby had to say. So just explain to us what is an oligarchy, how does that compare to a democracy, and then give your reaction to the tech billionaire powerhouse that is growing in Washington.
Sure, thank you. So I think the first point to make is that oligarchy is not a new phenomenon, nor is democracy, of course. I mean, this goes back to ancient Greece, which where we had the first democracies and the first oligarchies. And so oligarchy, which in sort of which is a Greek word, means the rule of the rich. And for most of human history, oligarchies have existed and they've challenged democracy. And so we have, of course, figures in American history like John Adams, American founders, worried about oligarchy. Martin Luther King Jr. uses the term and is worried about it. So this is a perennial problem. But what we've seen with the rise of the tech billionaires is I agree, a new manifestation of oligarchic power, which is based on technical expertise and success in technology, and then trying to translate that into political power. And so previous oligarchs might have been in other industries or might have had land holdings or might have been in other sorts of commercial activities. Say the Koch brothers, for example, were not in technology. And so this is a new phenomenon in some ways, and it's something that I agree bears a lot of scrutiny.
And let's talk about the optics of it a little bit, because these tech billionaires were on the front row. They were in front of the cabinet members. What do you think just the optics of having them with this front row seat, basically the closest of all those advisors to the president, what does that say to the American people when you see that?
Yeah, and I think somebody had commented that, there were congressional officials or Supreme Court justices who, and this is an equal branch of government, who had a less prominent seating position than some of these tech billionaires, which was very striking. And so I think it says, first of all, that from President Trump's perspective, he is the dominant oligarch in a group of oligarchs, in a sense, because he is out front, right, optically. But I think there's this remarkable convergence where, oligarchs, tech oligarchs from different industries who might have, might be business rivals or might be in different facets of the tech industry are converging on that inaugural stage. As somebody who studies this, it was one of the most striking images that I've ever seen because it really dramatically, I think, illustrated the point that Biden had been making, a few weeks earlier.
Yeah, and I have a quick follow-up to Bobby, because I wanted to ask you, as a collective, what kind of power and access does this give to this group of tech billionaires? Because we look at them individually as being powerful, but what kind of power do they wield as a collective?
I mean, I think this is a new class now in Washington, and obviously, I think the symbolic leader of this is Elon Musk, who some are calling the shadow VP. I guess there was just a squabble recently as to whether he's going to get his own office in the White House. But putting that aside, I mean, as a collective, I think they can push for a unified theory of, as few regulations on the tech industry as possible. But it's worth noting that there really aren't any tech regulations in the US, in terms of any kind of meaningful regulations, especially compared to European Union. I mean, the only piece of tech legislation that Congress passed in Biden's term was a ban of TikTok, right? No national privacy law, no AI regulations. I mean, you name a controversial tech issue, and Congress hasn't passed a law around it. So they want to maintain the status quo there for sure. But there's going to be fissures. I mean, already you're seeing the CEO of OpenAI, Sam Altman, fight with Elon Musk over this Stargate project, this big supposed $500 billion plan to build new AI infrastructure across the US, and whether there's enough money to actually get that off the ground. Elon is such a mercurial, unpredictable, an impulsive character in Silicon Valley, and has already fought with almost every single one of the other tech CEOs of these companies. So, yeah, it's just a matter of time before you're going to see a lot of fighting among this tech elite class. But yeah, as a unified group, I think they can probably come to a consensus when it comes to certain, policies and priorities that, again, will preserve their wealth, preserve their power, and sort of boost their bottom line for shareholders. And now they can look to China and say, oh, hey, did you guys read about that crazy new AI technology coming out of China? What a threat that is. If you regulate us, we're going to lose the AI race even more.
Give us
So,
more power.
yeah,
Well,
exactly.
Bobby Allen, WHYY alum, I should say,
That's
technology
right.
correspondent for NPR. Thanks so much for your time. You've set us up beautifully for the hour. Hopefully we'll talk again soon, Bobby.
I hope so. Thanks, guys. See you, Cher. See you, Avi.
See you
See
later.
you, Bobby. So let me actually, that last point, I want to move this over to you, Gordon Arlen. Bobby talked about the possibility of infighting. Because oligarchy is weird in that it's sort of this group of elites trying to work together, but individual elites have their own agendas. So historically, how is oligarchic power enforced so that there is like a unity of purpose and they can continue to dominate a society? Or is that the natural tension that tends to break oligarchies apart?
Yeah, and so you're right. I mean, infighting is always a big issue in the history of oligarchy. One way that oligarchs have maintained sort of power is through institutions that allow them to actually dominate, for example, senates in ancient Rome or other institutions where there are property qualifications. So basically, these are institutions that are not open to everybody, but where only people who have a certain amount of wealth can participate. And that can maintain a certain degree of solidarity. Of course, we've gotten rid of those institutions in the United States. We have one person, one vote. And so now, oligarchs, exert power in other ways, like through super PACs or through control of mass media, through tech, through running for office and winning, whether it's J.B. Pritzker in Illinois, Michael Bloomberg, Trump, Silvio Berlusconi in Italy, kind of predated some of this. And so there are different pathways, but infighting is always on the table, and often the biggest threat actually to oligarchs is their fellow oligarchs.
Yeah, I want to just reiterate our question for our listeners today. Are you worried about the role tech billionaires are playing in the Trump administration and their influence on policy and politics? Our number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And for our folks on YouTube, be sure to leave your comment in the chat. We have a couple callers waiting, so I'll bring one in. We have Joe from Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Joe, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, Cherry. Hi, Avi. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Joe.
I am definitely one of those citizens who is really concerned about oligarchy in this country. I think that a lot of people, unfortunately, do kind of live their day-to-day lives. They're not really aware of everything that's happening in Washington, but I am definitely concerned. And it's telling because if you saw recently, they actually polled people and asked them, like, do you know what oligarchy is? And a majority of Americans don't even know what it is. So that in itself is really concerning. And then just looking at, the current administration, like you were talking about how many people they brought in, not even in official cabinet roles, but just influence within their administration, who obviously have different agendas and, of course, obscene amount of wealth. And they're really trying to shape the way that this administration operates. So for sure, I'm definitely concerned. And I do kind of lean more progressive. So I've been looking at this stuff probably a lot more closely than average voters, but Yeah, it's really concerning, and I hope maybe this is a turning point where more people in the public are aware of what's going on and want to actually be a part of the process of, you know, doing something about it.
Thanks, Thank you so much, Joe, from Cherry Hill. And I want to read this email from Ben, who says, does oligarchy require an authoritarian government or an authoritarian-leaning government? In Russia, oligarchs only exist at the pleasure of Putin. If you cross him, you will lose your position, power, businesses. I think when we think of oligarchy, we always think of Russia in the back of our heads, right? And so I want to sort of like, there's a range, right? So can you explain what's been happening in Russia and this thing that people kind of understand as an oligarchy, and then explain how what seems to be forming in America is different, or is it, or what, where the similarities are?
Yeah, it's a really important question. So the term oligarchy became very salient in the 1990s after the fall of the Soviet Union because of privatization and the rise of these Russian billionaire oligarchs. And so that word for a long time has been part of the political discourse more in the post-Soviet world than in the United States. There are crucial differences because I think that the point I would want to make is that you don't have to have an authoritarian system to have oligarchy. It can happen in a democracy. You can have oligarchic power within a democracy. So
even when elections remain free.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, the biggest concern. And that's, you know, what scholars are really looking at is it's a much more complicated issue than just saying we're going to overturn democracy, which used to be the issue. Now it's like, how do we have a democracy with free and fair elections, which still has this huge amount of oligarchic power?
Can you explain that coexistence, how it could happen, where perhaps it has happened historically?
Well, you know, I would go back to Citizens United, for example, as a crucial moment. I would, you know, one point I want to sort of emphasize, because in America, there's, for good reason, a really important veneration of entrepreneurship, of wealth creation. And I want to emphasize that the critique of oligarchy is not a critique of private enterprise, and it's also not necessarily a critique of the wealthy. It's a critique of a very small group of super rich people who, on the basis of their wealth, exert enormous political power. So most rich people are not oligarchs. And I think sometimes that's, you know, confused, but I think that's an important point to make.
So let's maybe bring this into the present and focus it a little bit. Because AGB on YouTube says, tech bros have been cozying up to politicians for years, but the rise of fascism and the rise of power within this group of billionaires has been concerning because of the flow of information and control of narrative. So when you think about the possibility of this group of rich people transitioning from just rich people to oligarchs, what defines that transition? Like, what are the tells that we have gone from one to the other? Is it control of information? Is it something else?
Yeah, well, it's a massive amount of political influence that is unimaginable for any other ordinary citizen, including other affluent citizens. Other affluent citizens, they might be privileged in various ways in their life, but they cannot exert the kind of power that Musk is exerting right now, or Zuckerberg, or Bezos, or Trump. And so it's this unimaginable amount of concentrated power that's an extension of massive wealth, that control of the information space is increasingly becoming one of the primary ways in which that power is exercised. Content moderation, trying to use social media platforms in a political way, this is something new. It's something that I think scholars are still trying to figure out.
Let's bring in another caller now. This is Kyle from Pottstown on line 4. Kyle, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm definitely concerned about this whole thing, mostly because 10 years ago, tech companies were basically all about trumpeting liberal views and DEI and just, you know, equality and all of that. But, you know, starting maybe 3 or 4 years ago, as soon as the winds of power began to change, they very quickly flipped script and were they just wanted to fall in line with the current, people in power. And it just proves that they don't really care about the users on their platforms. Really, they just care about engagement and putting favors for the party that's currently in power to avoid retaliation. And honestly, just to, you know, in order to do that, they gain favors or better policies for the companies themselves in order to make more money. And it's not about the people's safety or well-being. Hmm. It's just for themselves.
That's Kyle from Pottstown. Yeah. Okay, so that self-preservation tactic. We'll talk about that more on the other side of the break. We also wanted to get into possibly on the other side of this break, sort of like how oligarchies are resisted.
Yeah.
How do they break apart? Because it does seem hard to break apart that type of concentrated power. We're talking with Gordon Arland, political science professor at Swarthmore, and we're hearing from you. Keep those calls coming. Keep those emails, studio2@whyy.org, and keep those comments coming in the YouTube chat. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Is America's democracy at risk of becoming an oligarchy ruled by ultra-wealthy elites? Perhaps they'll both exist at the same time. Folks like Musk, Zuckerberg, Bezos. That's what we're talking about today with Gordon Arland, a visiting assistant professor of political science at Swarthmore College. He is writing a book all about oligarchy. After President Biden's mention, by the way, the word oligarchy surged in search frequency.
Wow, not surprised about that. Our question for you today, our listeners, is this. Are you worried about the role tech billionaires are playing in the Trump administration and their influence on policy and politics? Our number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on WHYY's YouTube channel, hello, and make sure you drop your comment in the chat. I want to read a couple of comments we got. We got an email from Jeff who says, although unions are not perfect, if we are headed towards an oligarchy, I would think unions are more important than ever. Matt emailed that this is a dated way to formulate the question. We are already an oligarchy. Biden's parting statement about it was, as with everything the DNC has done for the last 20 years, is too little, too late. Also, Lars emailed and says, this is like in the early 20th century, where the newspaper magnates got a little too close to our political leaders. The social media platform broligarchs, Lars says,
I like that.
Are getting too close to President Trump means the possibility that Trump can exchange favors to them and their business ventures if they promote his agenda. And I had a question for you, Gordon, because I was thinking back to what former President Biden had said, talking about the Gilded Age and the industrialists who had become, in many ways, oligarchs, and the people pushed back against that. Can you take us back to that time? Was an oligarchy forming there, and what was the resistance method?
Yeah, it's a great historical analogy. Certainly, you had the progressive era and many of the same challenges, you know, these activists were confronting: the rise of monopoly power, the rise of, you know, concentrated wealth and power. And they did fight back through unionization, through trying to, you know, support independent media, through having courts that could, in some sense, be more progressive. Of course, when we got into the Roosevelt era, you had a shift from a conservative Supreme Court to a more progressive Supreme Court, which helped. So it was a multi-front effort, but it wasn't easy. And in some sense, the Second World War was actually quite important as well in sort of reconstituting politics, because there's a lot of political science. We don't want a war. That's not the solution to this. But there's a lot of political science research that when you have mass mobilizations that can, in some instances, contain the super wealthy, because there's a kind of national unity. And so, of course, that's not the solution that we want, but it was complex. But it is hopeful, I think, to know that there is this, that we've been through some of this before. Mm-hmm. And
when you say some of this, though, I think that's the big question I have, because lots of people in the comments are bringing up that period of time.
Yeah.
And Biden did himself. Like, how similar actually is it to this? Like, I truly don't know the answer to that. I mean, newspapers were very, very powerful in that time. So having control of information through that means, I imagine, was incredibly important. I don't know how it compares to having control of X or Facebook, et cetera.
Yeah. And you know, certainly there today is a much more pluralistic media landscape, and the questions about sort of fake news and the questions about sort of a lack of consensus around the facts. I'm not quite sure whether that issue was quite as prevalent it, you know, 100 years ago. I'm sure there was some of that.
Right.
But you didn't have, for example, a presidential candidate refusing to concede an election and then have a whole movement around that claim during the progressive era, to my knowledge. And so I think that's the big challenge with this new media landscape. So in a sense, the challenges are also related to who the oligarchs are, which is the tech oligarchs. I want to be clear that it's not just tech oligarchs. There are other oligarchs out there as well who are not in tech. But I think there's a reason why we're focusing on this and why Biden did as well, because that is not quite something we saw 100 years ago.
Yeah. And I wonder what is the risk of having, you know, billionaires who run companies that control our information, that have algorithms that can suppress or amplify different forms of media that we see. What is the biggest risk, you think, of having them be the oligarchs that run the country?
Yeah, there are several. So one big risk would be a classic risk, which is the risk that an individual oligarch could be allied with a foreign power. This was a problem in ancient Greece, where you had Athenian oligarchs who there was suspicion that they were allied with other city-states that were enemies of Athens. And so, for example, Musk's ties to Russia, I think, are concerning. And so that's something to watch. Another concern would be, again, just maintaining this parallel universe, this information ecosystem that makes it difficult for Americans to come together and really operate through a shared set of facts. That's so dangerous for a democracy. That will erode a democracy. And I think one thing that President Biden, you know, I think the fascism language was used a bit in the campaign and I think the oligarchy language might have been a little better, actually, because I think it's something that's a bit more tangible in some, and I could say more about that. But I think that President Biden was right to raise the alarm. And, you know, there is still more that we can do, but the first step is recognizing where we are right now.
John on YouTube agrees. A step the media can take is create a better term than oligarchy. Most U.S. voters do not understand the term oligarchy, but talking about definitions and drawing attention there. AB says there are three vice presidents and none of them are Vance, referring to Musk, Zuck, and Bezos. Ballet Boy says we have to ask ourselves, what is the cost of progress? Progress isn't always a positive upward slope. Will we ever give up the convenience, joy, and at times addiction of social media and tech? We're not going to be able to answer that question today, but it is, of course, a resonant one. I wonder a little bit how different you feel Musk, Bezos, Zuckerberg are to just a generation ago. The Koch brothers, and there are so many ultra-wealthy political donors. They're obviously trying to influence policy. There's no doubt about that. I think... Do you see a categorical difference between that generation and this generation of wealth?
Yeah, so I think that the power that the Koch brothers exercised, which is a really important case, was very, it was about mobilizing a network. We called it the Koch network of activists. It was a very sophisticated network of organizations that were intertwined. The Koch brothers themselves were not particularly charismatic or public-facing people, unlike... you know, maybe somebody like Musk, who is extremely public facing.
Yeah.
So that's one crucial difference.
Is that important for oligarchy, though? Because I don't know. Like in Russia, are the oligarchs public faces in that way?
Few of them are. Most of them are not. I mean, yeah. I think, though, one could argue that it's actually more dangerous to have oligarchic power that's more shadowy. That's less public facing.
You're just saying that's a key difference between the two generations. Yeah,
it is. So maybe there's something positive about that because the problem is in some sense more in front of us.
It's right in your face. Actually, someone commented that. I don't have it right in front of me. They said, here it is. Michael says, oligarchy has always been here in the USA. Robert Morris, the Rockefellers, Henry Ford, J.P. Morgan, DuPont, and so on. The only difference now is it's in our faces due to the internet. I mean, is that really true, what Michael's saying?
There is some truth to that. Yeah. I mean, totally. And so... I think it cuts both ways. I think it gives me some hope that maybe there'll be ways to sort of monitor these oligarchs and kind of hold them accountable because they are so public facing. But then there are also dangers, real dangers as well, in having that kind of public facing persona.
Yeah, I want to bring in another caller. We have Dan from Philadelphia on the line. Dan, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks so much for taking my question. I was just curious, you know, it felt like a few years back, all you would hear about was, you know, Soros, Soros, Soros. It felt like the Republican Party really successfully marketed that the Democratic Party was the wealthy elite party, yet here we are with all the billionaires having lined up for Trump. How did they win that marketing war? Why do people think that the Democrats are the rich party?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a tough one. Thanks, Dan. I mean, do you want to take a run at that, Gordon? Because that's in some ways a question about messaging and positioning and politics. But do you think you can help explain how that happened? Because for a lot of people look at that and they are baffled that the Democrats are portrayed as the out-of-touch rich party.
Yeah, and you know, with social scientifically, what you'd have to do is actually look at the whole class of billionaires. And I think what you'll see is it's pretty even, mm-hmm. right? And so what's interesting about oligarchy is that on many issues, like, say, social issues, like, you know, abortion or something, oligarchs mm-hmm. might disagree, but they often converge on certain issues that are salient to them as a class, like their power and influence. And so somebody like Soros could be on one side, somebody like the Koch, you know, Koch could be on the other side. But how, you know, you're right, it is partly about messaging. I think partly what we see is, you know, I think there is some data that Harris did win a larger share of affluent voters, but then there's this core group of billionaires around Trump. Mm-hmm. And so it's a bit of a, maybe a dichotomy between what we would call the mass affluent, the professional sort of coastal elite, which may be going for Democrats, and then this billionaire class that's around
it
Trump.
It does
right
cloud
now.
The picture. It does.
I want to read this comment from May from Levittown, who says, what has happened to we the people? And Frank emails, Citizens United opened the money flood from super PACs, and both major parties gladly accepted. It's up to the politicians to say no and do something to regulate dark money. And my question for you, as we talk about resistance to sliding into full oligarchy here, are there any legal safeguards that exist right now to block it? What are some of the tools that the American people have to sort of limit this power that seems to be growing and could soon be unchecked?
Yeah, I mean, I actually do think that independent media organizations like PBS are actually quite important in you know, maintaining sort of a shared set of facts and norms. But that's not alone enough. And I think you're right to bring up the courts, because so much of American politics today is determined by the courts.
Yeah.
And so to the extent that we're going to see progress on, you know, containing oligarchy, it will have to probably go through the courts at some level. But there are problems with that also, because the courts are not particularly democratic. You know, in ancient Athens, they had a variety of accountability mechanisms. For example, oligarchs could be exiled from the city. They could be forced to do community service. They were forced to account for their conduct in front of popular juries. And a lot of scholars are trying to rethink what it might mean to get beyond just voting, to think about other institutional mechanisms for popular power. So that's an ongoing discussion.
Because I wondered, you know, unions were a big way to kind of, you know, with these big companies at the turn of the 20th century, unions sort of took some of that power back. Are there other things that we the people have access to that could stop it?
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting that with, you know, the union movement itself is now kind of divided, and you know, there's some questions about endorsements and so on during the campaign. So there's, you know, you see a segment of organized labor that is, you know, going to one side of the spectrum and a segment that's going to the other side. And so that makes it difficult for unions to be totally the bulwark. Again, this isn't about one party, one political party or one side. This is an issue that's relevant to all Americans.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, in the end, it's about what kind of democracy do we have? Do we have a system where the people actually exercise power, where they actually rule, where a handful of billionaires are not controlling our destiny in such a powerful way? And I think, you know, civil society, other forms of social media, because social media is a double-edged sword, but we saw in the Arab Spring, for example, social media can be used to
mobilize.
There is
popular power in those platforms.
Yeah.
Before we go, let's just bring up a really heterodox idea, and I don't have time to bring in the caller. Steve's on the line, and I'm sorry, Steve, but I'm just going to summarize a little bit. Steve's talking about the idea that these oligarchs were formerly aligned with Democrats, so they actually might be like a balancing force on Trump, right? And that brings up this whole idea of oligarchy as a stabilizer, right? As sort of a centrist power as opposed to a malign power. How do you reckon with that? We only have about a minute left.
Okay. Well, no, I think it's a great point, and I think I agree that this is at least one role that oligarchs can play, is counterbalancing other oligarchs. And to the extent that you know, we might want to look then at who could counterbalance the oligarchs on one side from the other side. And but that's an imperfect solution. But it is, you know, if you think oligarchy is sort of the game in town right now, then it's something at least for the short term to focus on, I would say. So it's a good point.
Right, because you can have opposition from the grassroots. You can just also have opposition from elsewhere at the top. And if you are sort of waving the white flag on oligarchy, I can see why that might appeal to someone. Well, look, we have to wrap up the conversation right now. Of course, we could go on for a long, long time. Thanks to Joanne and Katie and John and Laura and Janae and all the folks we didn't get to, JST on YouTube. And thanks to you, Gordon Arlen, political science professor from Swarthmore College. Really appreciate the time. You dropped a lot of knowledge on us, including the stuff about exiling the oligarchs in ancient Athens. That's going to be rattling.
You went all the way back.
That's going to be rattling around in my head all day. Gordon Arlen, thanks for the time on Studio 2.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you so much to our producers for today's show. Thank you to Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Thanks to all our Studio Tubers watched online, and to everyone who listened today. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm thinking about exile right now. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, exiled until tomorrow when we talk to you again on Studio 2.